Morning, everybody. Looks like down to my clock today. All right, well, what we've got ahead of us today is sermonizing on a good part of Solomon's life. I'm not going to tell you how to prepare sermons, so if that's what you came for, sorry. Probably what will come out is how I set about preparing these particular sermons. And if we don't cover the four of them, as far as I'm concerned, that doesn't matter. I'd far rather we sort of nutted through and interacted on as much as we need to, starting with the first part, and see how far we get. But if we get through the four, well, that's fine. The reason I chose these sermons was, I think, prescribed by the number of slots I had available to me. I first preached these particular sermons in the Moore College Chapel, and I was given, I think, three slots. And I wanted to make something of Solomon out of that, and then subsequent to that, with the Church Missionary Society up in Queensland and northern New South Wales, they run a seniors retreat or something. They gave me four slots, and I said, well, I'll do four on Solomon. That'll give me a chance to get the Queen of Sheba in. So that's how, more or less how it came about. Why I'm telling you that is simply that very often the way we do arrange a sermon series may be because of things outside the sort of the realm of what would be the ideal in order to cover this particular material. If you're arranging your own program and so on, that may not be a problem to you. So I had to ask myself, how could I give a sort of an all-rounded picture of the first part of Solomon's reign, leading to the sort of the climax of what is seen to be a very positive thing about Solomon in 1 Kings, in a short number of sermons. So I don't think I would normally want to try to cover two chapters of 1 Kings in one sermon, unless I thought that it could be done without sort of missing a lot of the main points. The pastor of our little church, who has me up and preaching every now and then, quite enough for me, usually works on the principle of he'll choose a book and we'll probably spend deal with one chapter per week, per Sunday. And that doesn't always work, because sometimes the chapter divisions, as you know, which were a late addition to the biblical text, aren't always very happy as far as, or solicitous in terms of the actual division of the material. However, here we go on 1 Kings 3 and 4. What I tried to do with these three sermons then was to highlight the main points of Solomon's reign before his apostasy, as it is recorded in 1 Kings 11. And I came at it from an angle of my biblical theological perspectives. That's about the only way I really know how to go to an Old Testament text. And so what I try to do is work according to the structures that as I perceive them. Now, you may not be happy with this. I'm just going to tell you what I did, and you can think for yourself whether you think this is a good approach. This is one of the diagrams that actually occurs in my book on preaching, but it is the same material that we've been looking at. Here we have the biblical timeline. Here we have the first 11 chapters of Genesis, leading to what I consider a key point in the redemptive historical process, beginning with the promises to Abraham and coming to a climax with David and the first part of Solomon's reign. So there you've got from Genesis 12 to 1 Kings 10. Okay? And in that, we have a series of events which are spelled out to you yesterday in terms of the calling of Abraham, his the promises made to him, the covenant promises, the reversal of all this in the captivity, the Exodus release as a redemptive process, entry, possession, development of theocracy, finally David's kingship, Jerusalem, and the temple built by Solomon. So that is the whole process in a positive sense of revealing the kingdom of God and the way of salvation into that kingdom in the processes of Israel's history from Abraham to David and the first part of Solomon. Then we went down the slippery slide to judgment, beginning with 1 Kings 11 and Solomon's apostasy, the breakup of the kingdom, the two exiles, and the failure of the return from exile to produce the kingdom of God. And while that was happening, the prophets came along and recapitulated this, hence the same dimensions, but at a higher level. Exactly the same things are going to happen, say the prophets in the future, but they will be perfect, glorious, and forever. End of Old Testament, it hasn't happened. Jesus comes along and is shown to be the fulfillment of all these things. So we have the three stages of biblical revelation in Israel's history, in prophetic eschatology, and fulfilled in Jesus. Okay? Now that last bit, of course, then requires us to look at the way we looked at the Voss diagram yesterday of the three comings of the end. The end coming for us in Jesus, the end coming in us by the Holy Spirit through the gospel, and the end as it will come with us in the consummation of all things at the end of the age. Okay, so when I look at an Old Testament passage, I suppose the first thing that I want to know is, the first thing I want to know is what is it about? That's obvious. But in terms of trying to plan my thinking and how I'm going to make the link to the gospel message, how I'm going to show that this is a passage which testifies to Christ, I find there is no difficulty in my mind about going from there to there, because the dimensions are there and we already know sort of what's in between. But if there are things in between, that is in the development of the Old Testament theology beyond the place where we are, that helps us to sort of clarifies it and shows how it was picked up and run with, how the Old Testament writers themselves are actually dealing with their own past, then that to me is a useful thing. Now, it may not be in terms of the particular person. That is, one of the things about Solomon is, although he seems to be a pretty significant figure in the thinking of the writer of 1 Kings, he doesn't seem to be terribly significant in the thinking of anybody else. That is, he hardly ever shows up again, even in the New Testament. There's only a couple of references to Solomon, and both of them are negative. You know, he's not arrayed as well as the lilies of the field, and a greater than Solomon has come. Sort of, you know, doesn't leave much room for sort of praise and grandeur or anything like that. So you have to ask yourself, well, where's it going to go? So, okay, so that's the structure of my thinking about, you know, the way through. And so what I will do, if I'm dealing with an Old Testament narrative text, which this is, I will want to know, try to work out what are the sort of the basic theological themes that are there. Do they have any further development in this period, whether it's, you know, in the prophetic eschatology or somewhere else, even in the Psalms or something like that? And then how are those themes picked up and run within the New Testament? Because it seems to me that's what we want to know is in the end as to how this is going to help us to become more like Jesus, not more like Solomon. All right, so I hope you've all read 1 Kings 3 and following. So if you've got your Bibles there, you might turn them up and we'll start. As I said, the first sermon that I worked up on this, I focused on two chapters 3 and 4, but as you know, chapters 1 and 2 deal with the end of David's reign, his demise, and the accession of Solomon. And I like to think the only reason that I didn't deal with chapters 1 and 2 was I was prescribed by the time available to me. Otherwise, it seems like be the, you know, taking the easy way out. Because there's no doubt about it, it's a pretty sordid tale. On the one hand, here we are, we can sort of stand back and sort of take the big picture and say, you know, there was David, you know, the king after God's own heart, and God made him promises about his son that would reign after him. And then as David is about to shuffle off the mortal coil and depart this life, the most incredible series of court intrigues and backstabbings and what have you go on, which I suppose, you know, you can draw many lessons from that as to you know, the way people behave even when they've got the promises of God to fall back on. So I didn't deal with those two chapters, but I don't want you to get the idea that, you know, they're irrelevant and you need to understand things in the light of that. However, having said that, there is no doubt in my mind that when you get to chapter 3, that the writer is A, very skillful, B, he is, what should I say, provocative, and thirdly, that he is quite convinced that there is something very good to be said about this first part of Solomon's reign, yet not totally unqualified in its goodness. And so right at the beginning of 1 Kings 3, he begins by saying that Solomon made a marriage alliance with Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and he took Pharaoh's daughter and brought her into the city of David until he'd finished building his own house and the house of the Lord. And in verse 2, the people were sacrificing at the high places, however, because no house had yet been built in the name of the Lord. Now, this is one of the things where you have to start, I suppose, being a little bit creative and imaginative, using a bit of imagination in trying to work out what the text is getting at. I'm quite convinced that there is indeed two sides to exegesis. One is a more scientific one in which you simply plod through and work out what the words are meaning as they're put together into sentences, into paragraphs and so on. And the other is to try to get a feel for the creative imagination of the writer, particularly when you're dealing with narrative texts. And so sometimes they'll leave you hanging with a bit of ambiguity. And I think verse 2 is somewhat ambiguous. Is he saying something negative, or is he saying something that is not so negative, in that the people were sacrificing to God in various places simply because there was no temple around? Well, almost as he says, well, I'm not going to give you time to think about that, he moves straight on to tell us that Solomon loved the Lord. So in the outline that you've got, I have taken up these following points. Firstly, that Solomon makes a request for an understanding mind and so on to rule his people, and this is given a test. In the sermon that I preached on this, I wasn't going to spend a lot of time on it. It's the best known story of Solomon, the Solomon and the two ladies. And yet even there will be tons of room for you to explore even the ambiguity there. And if you've ever read around on this, you'll realise that there are some commentators who come down on exactly the opposite view of the usually held one as to what Solomon's about there. But I think that what I wanted to do was to move on to try to uncover much more about the way Solomon is seen to be the wise king and what that meant. And one of the reasons I did that was as a personal one, you might say, a matter of personal interest, because in my graduate studies I specialised in the wisdom literature, and as a biblical theologian I was intrigued by the fact that so many biblical theologians would tell you that there is a great difficulty in incorporating the wisdom material of the Old Testament into a broader sort of theological or a theology of the Old Testament. In fact, I did a paper when I was doing a master's degree on the problem of incorporating wisdom literature into the writing of Old Testament theologies. And I just examined about 10 different Old Testament theologies starting back in about 1896 and working through to people like Hart von Rath in the 1950s, and found that every one of them had handled the wisdom literature like a hot potato or like a greasy pig. You know, they just didn't seem to get a hand on it and know what to do with it. In more recent times, people have said that they've tried to deal with it by saying the wisdom literature fits into a theology of creation. What intrigued me was everybody came to these conclusions by looking at Proverbs and Job and Ecclesiastes and some of the Psalms, which were thought to be wisdom style and so on, and said, we can't find anything to do with salvation history or the the cult of Israel or anything like that. So these people must have a totally different point of view. I can't think of any of them who thought of going back to the narrative literature that was deals with salvation history and seeing how wisdom was to be found there. And I think, here, you've got it. I mean, surely, with all the traditions, even coming out in the book of Proverbs, that Solomon had something to do with it. And here is Solomon, right at the very climax of salvation history, and the climax is brought about when he asks for wisdom. I mean, what more do you want? So, yeah, I didn't quite say that in my dissertation on the subject, but, it seems to me that there are two ways of coming towards it. So I'll tell you what I did with this then, and see what you think. You've got the outline. That's the outline of my sermon. I started with an introduction, which I felt was, just to sort of lead in on this. I said the New Testament has numerous references and allusions to wisdom, and not least is the identifying of the gospel as God's wisdom and of Christ as our wisdom. And also I said this, I wanted to sort of make this, give it a sort of a more general platform, and said that we need to work as Christians towards a world view, and we need a point of reference. We need somewhere to stand as our key reference point for understanding the world around us and life and so on. And I've just, used a couple of illustrations as to how when I visit a city I don't know, one of the best ways is to find the highest vantage point and just try and get a feeling for what is around you, somewhere to stand so you can sort of see things. And most cities have a place where you can do that. So my only reason for then moving into chapter 3 was to provide a sort of a basis for what comes in the later chapters, that Solomon, when he comes to his accession and has in front of him an enormous task. Now, you have to... depending on where your congregation are at and so on, you may want to feed them a bit of information as to what had happened before that. The fact that David, when he took over, proceeds to bring Israel, you might say, to its zenith in terms of power, in terms of real estate and so on. That David was an extraordinary military leader, an extraordinary administrator, and introduces all kinds of things which had never existed before, like a standing army, a public service, and so on and so forth. And you could contrast that with the sort of, the tribal league loosely held together from Joshua onwards, and see how David sort of got together. And with David, there also begins the wisdom business in earnest. It doesn't begin with him. Stephen tells us it goes back, to Moses, who was skilled in all the wisdom of Egypt. But David is the one who, with his public service, also has a bunch of people who are his counselors. And that's a new thing, to have counselors. But then here's Solomon. And Solomon loves the Lord. He walks in his statutes, 1 Kings 3:3, and in the statutes of his father David, only, now what does only mean there? Except that? or only he sacrificed and offered incense at the high places. Is this something bad? Well, we'd have to wait and see, I think. He went to Gibeon to sacrifice, for there was the principal high place, and Solomon used to offer 1,000 burnt offerings on that altar. At Gibeon, the Lord appeared to Solomon in a dream by night. And it doesn't seem that the Lord was angry with him for going to Gibeon. And he says, ask, but I shall give you. And Solomon says, you've shown great and steadfast love to your servant, my father David. By the way, steadfast love, as you probably know, is one of the usual translations of the little Hebrew word chesed, which means probably something like covenant faithfulness. None of the English versions sort of do it justice, in my view. It's a covenant word, and it is usually spoken of God's faithfulness to his people. And it's not just God is sort of, oozing love towards them and feeling sentimental towards them, but that he is being faithful to the promises that he has made. And so Solomon, we know, makes this request. He says in verse 7, I am only a little child. I do not know how to go out and go in. Verse 9, give your servant therefore an understanding mind to govern your people, to be able to discern between good and evil, for you, who can govern this, your great people? And it pleased the Lord that Solomon had asked this. And so with this request, the Lord tells him that because he hasn't asked for riches or for a life, long life and so on, he says, I'll do what you've asked. But in verse 13, I give you also what you have not asked, riches and honour all your life. No other king shall compare with you. But if you will walk in my ways, keeping my statutes and my commandments as your father David walked, then I will lengthen your life. So then he wakes up and has a dream, and then we have the event of the two ladies and the squabble over the baby and Solomon's wise decision. So that the end of the chapter, verse 28, all Israel heard of the judgment that the king had rendered, and they stood in awe of the king because they perceived that the wisdom of God was in him to execute justice. Now, in my sermon notes, I put be brief between and all that, because I say you could have a whole sermon on that. And that in itself would create its own problems, because then you would be much more restricted in the perspective as to how you're going to get from that to where you want to go. So for me, that was just an introduction to the fact of Solomon being granted wisdom. And what I was more interested in was to see how that wisdom was spoken of and how it manifested itself beyond this point. No doubt about that, that is a manifestation of it. But it seemed to me that what the writer wanted us to understand was that the wisdom of Solomon actually extends to the whole of the account, which goes from here to through the coming of the Queen of Sheba to test Solomon with wisdom questions. And sort of the climax there is a Gentile comes and challenges Solomon to a sort of wisdom Olympics. And Solomon, you know, wins hands down because the fear of the Lord is in him. And so there is a theological point there. In fact, there are two theological points without wanting to anticipate too much in 1 Kings 10. There may be more than that. And one is, of course, the coming of the Gentiles into the light according to Genesis 12:3. And the other is the fact that Solomon's wisdom leaves her breathless. This is a classic example of the fear of the Lord being the beginning of wisdom. And of course the ghastly enigma of Solomon is in the very next chapter. He goes sour and starts marrying foreign women and building temples to their gods, and we begin on the slippery slope. So that is the sort of the problem and the enigma of Solomon. And here he is being built up and built up and built up, and he brings the glory of Israel and Jerusalem to its climax, and then he proceeds to white ant, put white ants in the boat shed, and things start to unravel. So chapter 3 to me was simply a means of leading into that, and I wanted particularly to concentrate on chapter 4. Otherwise your sermon would get too long. So in the second point then, which I move on to chapter 4, I've headed as wisdom, riches and honour as covenant fulfilments. Now, I am ready freely to admit that there may be room to challenge some of my exegetical conclusions. And let me say that I make the exegetical conclusions in the, I think I'm justified in making them in the light of the wider context, not just the wider context of 1 Kings, but the wider context of the whole of salvation history in Israel. Okay, that's the way I work. And if you don't work that way, you may feel that I've overstepped the mark here. So it seems to me that this chapter, chapter 4, begins off by explaining something of the wisdom of Solomon. That is, we start to ask ourselves now, what is this wisdom? It's already manifested itself in his ability to make what is perceived, however we want to understand it, but it's certainly perceived and reported as being a very wise judgment with regard to the two ladies and their squabble over the babies. But what about what comes after this? And it seems to me that the writer wants us to understand that these things that he is describing about Solomon's kingship and the splendor of his court are also part of this package deal of being given wisdom. So 1 Kings 4 begins with the list of his officials, and one would, I think, hesitate very much to sort of make this the major reading for the day, other than to point out the fact that it begins by saying that King Solomon was king over all Israel, and these were his high officials. Or verse 7, Solomon had 12 officials over all Israel who provided food for the king and his household, and each one had to make provision for 1 month of the year. Now, you might want to feel that is just simply part of sort of reporting about how things were with Solomon. I want to suggest to you that this is part of the description of the result of Solomon's wisdom. But he was able to get his act together and to get the kingdom together in such a way that it was splendid, it was prosperous, and so on. And I think I'm helped in that by the way the narrative goes on in verse 20. Judah and Israel were as numerous as the sand on the sea. They ate and drank and were happy. Solomon was sovereign over all the kingdoms from the Euphrates to the land of the Philistines, even to the border of Egypt. And they brought tribute and served Solomon all the days of his life. Solomon's provision for one day was blah, blah, blah. Verse 25, during Solomon's lifetime, Judah and Israel lived in safety from Dan even to Beersheba, all of them under their vines and their fig trees. Now, what's he describing? He's not only describing the fact that Solomon had lots of people running around doing important things to keep the kingdom, you know, in order and stable and so on, but he starts using covenant terminology. For instance, in verse 20, Judah and Israel were as numerous as the sand of the sea. Well, you know, you might need to point it out, but a lot of people would pick that up straight away, that this was the promise made to Abraham, that his descendants would be like that. Now, it may have just been a very commonly used metaphor for lots and lots and lots, but it seems to me that it's pretty pointed at this stage that having described Solomon having reached this stage, that the nation over which he rules is described as having reached the point of the fulfillment of covenant promises. And even the riches were there and the provisions for the court seems to me to have overtones of the kind of prosperity, and I'm not urging a prosperity doctrine here, but there is a sense in which to understand the way things are and the way things relate, the book of Proverbs presents a lot of material of that kind, that if you act wisely, you get good results. That's just the way the world is. Now, the problem with the book of Proverbs is that sometimes things for us go wrong, and Proverbs seems to be airy-fairy and rather just over-optimistic, and that's where the book of, say, Job comes in. But nevertheless, there is this sense that get your act together, understand the way things work, have a perspective on the world which understands what it is and how it works, and you get good results. Now there are lots of things in life that we know that's the way things work, and that is behind the way people of all cultures understand their wisdom and actually write their wisdom literature. I remember browsing around in the library at Union Seminary, and they had a whole section on proverbs from various nations. You could have a volume of Chinese proverbs, Welsh proverbs, Yiddish proverbs, Polish proverbs, and so they went on. And it was easy to see that a lot of them were very much the same. You know, they had national characteristics. Yiddish proverbs had a certain interesting Jewish sense of humour and built in, and so on and so forth. But they're talking about just getting a handle on life. Okay, and verse 25 is also important. And again, we mightn't understand the fullness of this of what is being said here without sort of making a few links. One is, of course, that in a sense it's Eden, isn't it? Every man under his vine and under his fig tree, dwelling in safety. The peace and the prosperity of God's kingdom. And of course the prophet Micah takes up the same thing, that for everyone to dwell under their vine and under their fig tree is an image of what it will be like when the kingdom of God comes. Okay, so you have then verse 20, there's numerous sands and seas. Now what occurred to me when I was looking at this, that some parallels are then drawn in the way the narrative is constructed. So you have in verse 20, that Judah and Israel were as numerous as the sand of the sea. And in verse 29, God gave Solomon very great wisdom and discernment and breadth and understanding as vast as the sand on the sea. Now, I couldn't substantiate it. I wouldn't want to go to the stake about this one. But it seems to me, he must have done that for a purpose. What's he saying? And then I looked in the work, there were other parallels. For instance, in verse 21, Solomon was sovereign over all the kingdoms from the Euphrates to the land of the Philistines. So Solomon rules over all these lands. So the extent of the land in verse 21 is then applied to the extent of Solomon's wisdom in verse 30 and 31. Solomon's wisdom surpassed the wisdom of all the people of the East and the wisdom of the Egypt. He was wiser than anyone else, and he names all these people who he was wiser. Then it seems to me that the blessings of dominion and rest in the land, verse 25, every man dwells under his vine and his fig tree, is extended to Solomon's wisdom in verse 32. He composed 3,000 proverbs, and his songs numbered 1,005. He would speak of what? The natures, the trees, and so on. Now, that might be fairly tenuous also. But it appears to me that verses 29 to 31 does carry some parallels to that earlier section, verse 28, which indicates that wisdom, Solomon's wisdom, parallels the overall movement that the people of God are experiencing now into something which at least approximates the fulfillment of all God's promises under the covenant. Now, if that is the case, what do we learn about Solomon's wisdom here? Well, I've mentioned a few points that seem to me that come to mind. The first thing is that the wisdom of Solomon, which is both a human activity and a divine gift, and that's important. I mean, you can spend a lot of time talking about the human responsibility to use the brains that God has given us to learn from our experience and so on, but also that wisdom is a divine gift. It's summed up, of course, in the rubric to the Book of Proverbs. That is the hermeneutical key to the Book of Proverbs is Proverbs 1 verse 7. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, and reiterated again later on in chapter 9, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. That's pretty clear from Proverbs that wisdom and knowledge are seen as virtually synonymous when you're in talking about this wisdom idea. But it's the fear of the Lord. Now, the fear of the Lord is a concept which occurs a lot of times in the early stages of the Pentateuch and so on, and right through, and seems to mean, in its broader sense, a faith response to the self-revelation of the covenant-making, the covenant-keeping God. So it's the fear of Yahweh. And Yahweh is the name that was revealed to Moses when God was showing himself to be the covenant-keeping God. So I think that although it is true to say that there is a sort of a creation sort of orientation to wisdom literature, it is also orientated to the covenant, simply by the fear of the Lord being the beginning of wisdom and knowledge. Okay, having said that then, the wisdom of Solomon, which is both human and divine, encapsulates God's revelation of reality in the context of the covenant of salvation. That is, what is God doing in this whole process of salvation history, of which Solomon is privileged to be, you know, the sort of the final part of this stage of revelation of the kingdom and of salvation? And God is not just saying, look, you know, believe in me and you'll be saved. He's giving an understanding of what reality is. He's giving an understanding of what the world is. That's what wisdom is about. What is in life? Now, we know that the narrative, as we jump ahead, will suddenly descend from these heady heights that we find Solomon Israel in, and the whole thing crashes. And so here's the enigma, and what is the lesson? We have to anticipate that. It's not necessarily the main point of the sermon at this stage. But we know that Solomon's grasp on wisdom was transitory. Very easily he stepped over the line. His dream started it all, so he may well ask, was this just a pipe dream? And if Solomon was so wise, as seen in this, and we have to move on from that in further unraveling sort of the process in these earlier chapters of 1 Kings, as to how this wisdom of Solomon shows itself, and climaxing particularly, I think, in the building and dedication of the temple, and yet it crashes. And the question that needs to be asked in anticipation is, will there ever be a wise ruler for the people of God? So I suppose what I'm saying is, at this stage, we're laying the foundation for understanding of wisdom, which is very great, very wonderful, but also very vulnerable and transitory. So what I did then was to move on to the third point of the sermon, which was to ask about the extension of this story. That was simply to raise the question as to, well, what did later writers or writers concerning later parts of the Old Testament deal with? How did they respond to this? And all I can come up with is saying that, unlike David, Solomon receives little acknowledgement in subsequent accounts in the Old Testament. He's referred to in historical texts and in wisdom books. You find his name pops up in, you know, Proverbs, Song of Songs. His name occurs in two psalm titles, Psalm 72 and Psalm 127. There's one historical reference to him in Jeremiah. That's all in the Old Testament. In the Gospels, Solomon is downplayed, not arrayed like the lilies, a greater than Solomon is here. But Solomon doesn't get an airing, but royal wisdom does. And I think that's important. Because what we're looking at here is the concept of a king as the bearer of wisdom. So how does royal wisdom get it? Well, in lots of places. And just to mention some of the main ones just briefly. One that would be quite obvious, which you've probably thought about already, would be Isaiah chapter 9, which is read every Christmas, probably. Chapter 9, verse 6 and following. A child has been born to us, a son given to us, authority rests on his shoulder, and he is named what? Wonderful Counselor. Yeah, there's a wisdom term. A Wonderful Counselor. He's the Mighty God, the Everlasting Father, the Prince of Peace. His authority shall grow continually, and there shall be endless peace. For the throne of David and his kingdom he will establish and will uphold it with justice and righteousness from this time forward and forevermore. So the Wonderful Counselor there, I think, would qualify as a passage or as a statement that the child, the messianic figure that will establish the throne of David and so on, is the wise counselor. But probably more important in chapter 11, the chopped down family tree of Jesse, the father of David, will be revived. A shoot shall come out from the stump of Jesse, and a branch shall grow out of his roots. The Spirit of the Lord shall rest upon him. What Spirit of the Lord is that? The Spirit of wisdom and understanding, the Spirit of counsel and might, the Spirit of knowledge and the fear of the Lord. There it is, the whole wisdom botanized. Just about everything you can say theologically about wisdom is there. I would say you could pick other passages too. But chapter 32 of Isaiah, I think, is also useful. Chapter 32, verse 16, then justice will dwell in the wilderness, righteousness abide in the field. The effect of righteousness will be peace as the result of righteousness, quietness and trust forever. My people will dwell in the peaceful habitation, in secure dwellings and quiet places, etc., etc. Why I mention that one is that righteousness, it becomes a key theme in the wisdom literature. It's important, I think, to ask some questions about some of these ideas and terms which we use. See, mostly people think of righteousness as an ethical thing, do they not? Which it is, but that's not what it solely is. And you can see that if you go to the book of Proverbs and see how the word righteousness becomes a synonym of wisdom. And a passage like Isaiah 32 is interesting because it seems to link righteousness with the putting together of nature again. See, the world has fallen because of human sin. But the day will come when justice and righteousness abide in the fruitful field. But when the world of nature even is once again what it ought to be, then that will be righteous. There's a German guy who wrote, it's quite old now, back in the 60s, I think, wrote a monograph, the title of which translates as simply as Righteousness as World Order. And he just simply does a study on the Hebrew root tzedek and all its cognates and in the Old Testament, and comes up with the conclusion that righteousness is far, far wider than just the sort of the ethical behaviour of people, but is in fact the way the world is constructed I suppose you might say it is a relational thing, and not just a human relational thing or a personal relational thing. It's a relational thing worldwide. So those are just a few that could be looked at. Isaiah 35, the wilderness and the dry land shall be glad, the desert shall blossom and rejoice like the crocus and so on. Verse 9, no lion shall be there, nor shall any ravenous beast come upon it. There shall not be found there, but the redeemed shall walk there, and the ransomed of the Lord shall return and come to Zion with singing. Everlasting joy will be upon their heads, and they'll obtain joy and gladness. And why, again, I mentioned there, because the narrative concerning Solomon suggests that something like this is beginning to happen. Every man under his vine and under his fig tree. In other words, there is fruitfulness in the land. There is abundance. The reference to nature in Solomon's songs and proverbs is curious. perhaps, but anyway, it's there. In the book of Proverbs, there are many instances of nature as the source and lessons of wisdom. You know, you can find it all over the place. Go to the ant thou sluggard. You can learn wisdom from lowly things like ants. Some of the numerical sayings in the last part of Proverbs contain lessons from nature. And we're told that Solomon, when he wrote his Proverbs, wrote about the hyssop that grows out of the wall and the trees and the birds and the fishes and so on. So he was obviously one who observed nature and learnt from it. All right, so the extension of the story then leaves us with the fact that, perhaps the key fact, that a messianic figure is promised who will embody royal wisdom.
On Solomon sort of naming all those animals,
as an expression of wisdom. See, I'm sure that what the Genesis passage is getting at is not that, you know, Adam looks and says, "Oh, it looks like a horse, so we'll call it a horse." But actually, this is the beginning of discerning distinctions, classifications, taxonomy, or whatever it is, so on. You know, hence, you know, Reformed theologians have usually referred to it as the cultural mandate in action. Well, so this third point is really just to say, look, there is a promise. Even though Solomon has descended into the depths after the heights to which he had risen, there is a promise. And the promise, I think, is in the context of wisdom, is a promise which embraces not just the king and a people, but embraces the whole natural world around us. And where I'm leading to this is, in the fourth point, in the triumph of wisdom, is that this, by endeavouring to do what we might call a close reading, sort of careful exegesis of the passage and so on, in its context, leads us to a better understanding of what it means for Jesus to be the true wise man and the true king. In other words, part of the lesson that I would want to make of this from the point of view of preaching from the Old Testament is that to try to counter the idea which you often meet and which we can easily slip into, you know, the old adage, a thousand are their texts, but all their sermons one. By leaping too quickly from the Old Testament to Jesus, you end up saying the same predictable things about Jesus. When I went back to Moore College in 95, I remember talking to some of the second year students about this very point of teaching and preaching from the Old Testament. And some of them were saying, you know, that they'd encountered this where people just sort of just said, well, ho-hum, here comes the Jesus bit. It was just so predictable because rather than seeing how the Old Testament text is a text in itself which needs to be grappled with and unfolded and dealt with and then seeing how that takes its meaning from its wider context and so on. They just took the sort of the most obvious thing, you know, here's a bit about salvation, here's something about sacrifice and so on, so next thing you're into, and Jesus died on the cross sort of thing. Now I think we need to do better than that, because if Jesus really does encapsulate, sum up, fulfill all the dimensions of God, humankind, and creation, then there must be endless ways of enriching our understanding of what Jesus was, who he was, and what he came to do in his life, death, and resurrection. So in the triumph of wisdom, which is the way I tried to draw this together, I started by saying, well, it's relatively easy to show how Jesus fulfills the role of Solomon. He's the king. Solomon was the son of David. Jesus is the capital T-H-E son of David. So what Solomon was promised to be but fail to be, Jesus comes and is perfectly. But put the question at the other end. How does Solomon testify to Christ and point up the vital dimensions, or point up some vital dimensions to the gospel? Well, I suggest these points. That even though Solomon gets virtually no airing at all, specifically in the New Testament, the role of Solomon as the son of David, the king of Israel, and the exemplary wise man is set out in this particular part of 1 Kings. And the fact that he fails leads us to point out that Jesus is the one who is greater than Solomon. It's not just that he's a better one, but that he fulfills all that Solomon was to be. Now, what was Solomon to be? Well, he was to be the king, he was to be the wise man. And in this, we can come back to my sort of heuristic at the beginning, that we need a reference point for the understanding of who we are, where we are, and what the world is about. And this, it seems to me, is something that is so important for so many Christians to grasp, because I'm sure all of you have wrung your hands in despair about Christians that you know who have dichotomized their lives, and they have their spiritual lives on Sundays and their Christian thinking, which goes about this far, and as for the rest, they live like secularists. That they have no real concept that somehow God and Jesus are relevant to what goes on in daily life around us. So Jesus Christ then fulfills the role of Solomon as being the wise point of reference, the one who exemplifies the fear of the Lord, which is to understand and to respond to God who reveals himself as to be the creator, the sustainer of the whole universe. The second point I'd make is that Jesus teaches in wisdom forms. It's probably not often brought out in general sermons on the gospel narratives and so on. But Jesus uses nature parables. He uses metaphors. The parables themselves are wisdom forms. And you'll remember how at the end of the Sermon on the Mount, he ends the Sermon on the Mount with a classic wisdom contrast between wise and fool. The wise man builds his house on the rock, the fool builds his on the sand. And the people were astounded. Why? Because he didn't teach like the scribes, because the scribes' approach to wisdom was to say, Rabbi such and such says this. This is rabbinic wisdom, you see. Rabbi such and such says this, Rabbi such and says that, Rabbi who's it says that, et cetera, et cetera. You've got all these different authorities saying. But he didn't speak like that. He spoke as one who had authority. He was the source of their wisdom. So it's not just that Jesus fulfilled Solomon by being the wise man. Jesus is wisdom. The third point I made there was that Jesus performs nature miracles, showing his lordship over nature. He demonstrates the new creation. Now, what are we saying here? Well, I think at least one thing we're saying, and I imagine there aren't too many Christians who really sort of contemplate this as a matter of course. See, what was Jesus doing in his life, death, and resurrection? Well, he was saving us from our sins. Of course he was. Of course he was. But has it ever occurred to us that as wisdom, what Jesus was doing in dying on the cross, amongst other things, was putting the universe back together? Now, I don't know about you, I think that's mind-blowing. I really do. That the benefits of Christ's death and resurrection will never be fully apprehended until we can contemplate the new creation, the new heavens and the new earth. All things restored to their rightful order. Now, all this is the wisdom of God, and we share that with him. I mean, all you need to do to start people thinking about that is, get them to sort of contemplate what Paul says at the beginning of, at the end of the first chapter of 1 Corinthians, or even those first two chapters of 1 Corinthians, in which he contrasts the wisdom of God, which is looked at as foolishness by the world, and the wisdom, the so-called wisdom of the world, which God declares to be foolishness. And he caps it off at the end of chapter 1, where he says of Christ, He is the source of your life in Christ Jesus. Source of your life in Christ Jesus, who became for us wisdom from God, i.e. righteousness, sanctification and redemption. So the ultimate wisdom is the wisdom of the righteousness which we have from God. And I put it to you that once again, the idea of righteousness. Now, Paul was a Jew, don't forget. He was a Jewish theologian. And I cannot believe he was so Hellenized simply because he wrote in Greek. But he started thinking like a Greek. I mean, he's constantly arguing against them. He does that right here. And so when he starts using terms like righteousness and redemption and so on, he must be using it more in the context of Old Testament thinking. And righteousness in the Old Testament simply cannot be confined to being good people. It is the putting together of all relationships in the way that they were intended to be. Now, okay, that virtually was where I drew the thing to the end. We have the mind of Christ, says Paul. Thus we have in the gospel the means for understanding what our universe, our world, and what human history is all about. The gospel then, if we understand it, not just as in this simplistic way that Jesus died on the cross so that I can go to heaven when I die, so we start to understand something of the texture of the gospel, then we can see that it really can be our place to stand, our point of reference in assessing all things, in understanding the place of all things. So what is the place that I may stand to see, to know what is real? Where do I stand to know myself? Where do I stand to know my life and my destiny? To know what will last? Where can I stand to know what are the end, what will be the end of this world's ills? Where can I stand to know the meaning of the universe? How can I know what is good in mankind and what is evil? How can I know what is the meaning of the Bible and the way into it? Well, Solomon gives us the clue, even though he lost the plot. And the clue points us to Jesus as the fulfillment of wisdom. So those are my four points. Just to run them through, we looked at the introduction in chapter 3 as the sort of the preface to it. The main point was chapter 4, where I suggested to you the parallel between the fulfillment of the covenant and the description of Solomon's wisdom. The extension of the story told us that even though Solomon had failed, a wise Messiah king would come, and Jesus fulfills that. Now, can you see what I've done with the fulfillment? I just haven't said Jesus fulfills it as if all the Old Testament was doing was saying, you won't find anything here that will last, you know, head for the New Testament. What I'm saying is, the New Testament presupposes, by picking up these themes, what you should know from the Old Testament. And that is why I am very happy to say, and say it just about everywhere I go, show me a church that doesn't preach and teach from the Old Testament, and I'll show it you a church that has a very woolly and superficial view of the gospel. Okay, discussion, questions. We've got 10 minutes or so of this session, and we can keep on next time.
Yeah, one instance about church.
Haven't you?
I
forget who I heard. Yeah, Proverbs 3:16. No, actually, I think I heard it first from the late Bruce Smith. I think he was referring to a mutual friend of ours who had gone to England. He suggested he might be running up to the college boat sheds and sticking white ants in them. I don't know why, but yeah. Well, I don't know.
Have you published it?
No, I haven't. No. All right. Okay.
Yes, I don't think so. Yeah, can we have a wise question?
Graham, you obviously use your quarters a great deal.
Well, I don't know whether we have or not. Yes, I think a concordance is important, but with this warning that, as I said yesterday, one must be very careful in using concordance and so on, not to simply descend into word studies as such. I mean, the word studies were seen at one stage as big time, and you probably, you know, are fully aware of the controversy about the great Kittel Werther book and how James Barr's book in the 1960s on the semantics of biblical language really did put the white ants in the boatshed, because after that the Kittel people had to turn around and sort of revise the way they approached it, because as Barr pointed out very clearly and obviously, that the same word can be used with different meanings, and that one meaning can be conveyed by lots of different words, and so if you use a concordance, it must, I think, always be with an eye to, first of all, you've got to be careful that when you do pick up the same word being used, that it is being used to cover the same concept. The principal of Moore College, when I was a student, always used to say, no theology from etymology. That is, root meanings of words do not provide the basis for theology. And so you've got to be careful with that one. But yeah, I have no hesitation in looking up a concordance. And concordances on disk are very useful from that point of view.
In picking up your diagram for 3D comps,
yeah.
Do you see covenant blessings in the transition between David and Solomon, Elisha, John the Baptist, Christ? And how does that impact on our sermon that we're looking at?
How does it impact on this sermon?
Yeah. Would you pick up the Elisha blessing as a setting stone
cross? Ah, you could. I think you've got to be careful. You know, if you're going to write a biblical theology of Solomon, you might do something like that. You've got to be careful not to throw the book at people in a sermon, I think. Otherwise, you know, if it gets too complex, they'll lose the plot. And so I would take the most direct line forward that I could. I mean, the Elisha one is interesting. The whole function of Elijah and Elisha during the period when everything is descending into chaos, and they seem to be saying at that point that the old order of things can be retrieved if only you will turn back to God. So that, you know, as I think Ronald Wallace, I first got this from in his little book on Elijah, pointed out, you know, the tussle on Mount Carmel. Isn't Elijah just doing bigger, better, brighter things, but referring to the covenant? Because what he does is tear down the altars of Baal and build the altar according to the Mosaic prescription. And fire comes down and consumes the burnt offering, which has done at least twice before. It's not a new thing. And so it's a back to Moses broadcast. So yes, I mean the covenant theme is one that could be brought out more strongly if you felt that was the way. What I wanted to do was to, I think it's a very neglected one and probably not well understood what wisdom is about. Anything else? Yes, Peter.
Trying to revisit the question I couldn't get out yesterday.
I'll try and understand it today.
This book, The First Kings.
Yep.
I assume comes from a period of Israel's history much later than the period to which it refers. In fact, it may come from as late as the post-Kittilic period.
It may do.
Therefore, this book is post-Isaiah 19, for example. Could it be that the book is being structured in such a way as to show, in line with the diagram, that Solomon did not fulfill the prophecy of Isaiah 19, but that we must look future.
Yep.
It's always, in a sense, reinforcing the looking at the actual chronology of the development of the literature. And, you jump from the text straight to, you've looked at the text closely, you've jumped to Christ, but you haven't gone through the composition of the text and when it was originally preached.
Yeah, I think that's a reasonable point. Obviously, the thing wasn't put together until after the end of the kingdom, and therefore, as you say, it's probably reasonable to assume it was put maybe sometime in the post-exile. We can hardly imagine, or maybe we can, somebody writing it in the exile. The only problem with that is, how do we know when it was? But all we can do, and of course, there's the problem of, when Isaiah 6 was composed, and we would probably assume that it's 8th century Isaiah who did that. Yeah, I think that would be a fair statement. I'm not sure that the conclusion you drew there, that he was showing then that Solomon hadn't fulfilled the Isaiah 6 and the Isaiah 11 passages, really changes anything that I've said. No, yeah. But your point, I think, is a good one. I just see that it leaves us with the problem of nailing down when the canonical recension, if I can put it that way, actually emerged into the life of the people of Israel. Now, obviously, when you're dealing with things miles apart, then you've probably got a better chance of saying this came before that.
I suppose a more relevant question than that question is, what function did this book have as an entity in the edification of God's people in the Old Covenant?
Yeah.
What place did it have?
Yeah. Well, and why did somebody think it was necessary to come along and reinforce the Davidic line by writing Chronicles? I think one of the things, if I had more time in this, if I had the time to do it, I would want to get stuck into the parallel account in Chronicles and just see how it was the same and how it was different. Chronicles, of course, is probably the most neglected narrative in the Bible, simply because we get to 1 Kings first. But it's a pity because Chronicles, since it focuses only on the southern kingdom, avoids all the problem of trying to work out who was king at the same time as who was king up north. And whether you're dealing with something that's happening in Israel or something that's happening in Judah, he just focuses on Judah and the Davidic line, which just sort of simplifies it for you. Yeah.
You wouldn't feel tempted in this particular passage to sort of deal with maybe perseverance of saints, just study that idea of Solomon seems to be in the covenant and then he seems to step away from the covenant towards the end there.
Look.
Maybe later in the series, I don't know, but just a question of how can someone be so wise and pretend to go the right direction?
Yeah, and be so stupid.
Yeah, I mean,
So the ultimate question is: Is Solomon in heaven? If there is grounds for doing so, if there are grounds for doing so in the text, and you feel that is the way you want to go, why not? It just so happened that you can't do everything. Again, if you were writing a biblical theology of the kingship of Solomon, you might be inclined to explore a whole host of things that I haven't touched on. I was mainly concerned because it seemed to me to be the main thrust of these chapters. Chapters 3 to 10, they begin and end very clearly with the wisdom of Solomon, and it seemed to me that the chapters in between also are highlighting his wisdom. Because to me that is such a neglected area, and when people deal with the book of Proverbs, for instance, recently I was sent a copy of a book by an American fellow on Proverbs to review, and in the end the people that asked me to review it, I think they they decided not to, to print my review because there wasn't much I could say about it. It was much use at all. In fact, I wrote them and said, what on earth are you going to spend space reviewing this book for? And of course, all the fella had done was rearrange the entire text of the Book of Proverbs according to the topics dealt with in the individual sayings. The question of, is there a theology here? And if there is a theology, how does that theology link with the theology of the New Testament so that I can read Proverbs as a Christian book? It just didn't really emerge. And that's something that I think we've got to come to terms with. I tried to do it when Paul Barnett asked me to do that little volume on reading Proverbs today, which the AIO in Sydney published. How do you write a commentary on Proverbs, which is a Christian commentary? Very difficult. So what happens with a book like Proverbs, it just becomes a lot of wise sayings, which, because they lack God talk, can be just applied directly. As if they don't belong to another context which links them with Christ being our wisdom. Okay, well, I think we've got to stop there, haven't we?
This recording is brought to you by thechristianlibrary.org.au.